produced by Jeffrey Caselius, Joseph Cottrell and Ken Fuller. This is Yes Music Podcast episode 612. Why did Rick Wakeman want Larry Fast? Part 2.
Hi, this is Tony Kaye and you're listening to the Yes Podcast.
Welcome to episode 612 of the Yes Music Podcast, two fans' exploration of the world's greatest progressive rock band. I'm your host, Kevin Mulrine, and co-host Mark Anthony Kaye will be along in a few minutes' time. You can always get involved with the podcast yourself via the various different ways on the site, yesmusicpodcast.com. Happy New Year to you. I hope you had a great time, whatever you were celebrating in midwinter or midsummer or something else, depending on where you are on the globe. This week, Mark and I returned to the second part of our discussion around why Rick Wakeman wanted Larry Fast to help him out on Tales from Topographic Oceans. We listened to Electronic Realizations for Rock Orchestra by Synergy, on which Larry played everything. Stay tuned to hear what we thought of the album from 1975. Around the socials this week, and specifically on the YMP discussion group on Facebook, Jeffrey Mason continued his epic contribution streak by adding the following. A question about whether Rick Wakeman ever set up his keyboards stage right. The new collector's Start Your Ear Off Right 2024 Cobalt Blue Vinyl Yes from 1969 from Rhino, which is coming on January the 5th, oh, that's today, 2024. Musine's article about Steve Howe and the Step DG1 digital guitar. Great photos of John Anderson and Chris Squire, along with Steve Howe playing steel guitar during Yes's March the 11th, 1974, Tales from Topographic Oceans tour concert in Oklahoma City at Fairgrounds Arena. Rick Wakeman's comments in a Music Radar article referenced later on in this episode that he didn't understand Tales. An article about the Buggles and Yes. Nancy Lewandowski reviewing Yes's Great Tormato concert at Buffalo Memorial Auditorium in 1978. A question about space rock. Never quite sure what that is. Rick Wakeman's debut Rick's Ramblings for 2024. A Rick Wakeman interview from 1974, Rick very much the theme, Gary McKenzie's review for Prog magazine of Steve Howe's Motif Volume 2, happy birthday to Hass Froberg of the Flower Kings, who waxes lyrical about Roundabout, and the latest Yes YouTube documentary, this time it's Going for the One. Doug Curran added the following list. News that a new Prog Collective album is coming on the 15th of March, with Billy Sherwood, Patrick Mraz, Rick Wakeman, and members of King Crimson, Utopia, Dixie Dregs, Angel, Soft Machine, Styx, Weather Report, Blue Oyster Cult, Nectar, The Aristocrats, and others. Pre-orders are open now as an album featuring everyone from Billy Sherwood's address book. A YouTube video featuring a beautiful prog rock star art gallery, including several we know well, and a happy birthday to Fish Out of Water by Chris Squire, released in the US on December the 30th, 1975. A hugely influential album for bass guitarists and others everywhere. Brian Sullivan posted a YouTube video of a remastered recording of Yes live in 1974, playing the Ancient from Tales, and Mike X. Hanratty wonders if Lenny Bruer's, is it Bro, 1969 guitar piece The Claw was an influence for Steve Howe's Clap. It's certainly in a fairly similar style. Charlie Nolan also spotted the Going for the One video and Alan White's Spring Song of Innocence, as well as a feature on Chris Squire from 1977. And Dave Watkinson showed off his remarkable Yes album topper, made by Gary from South Shields. You may remember that name from a certain book about Tormato. Over on Twitter, or rather X.com, I noticed that Yes Official haven't posted anything on that platform since the 6th of December. I assume they've taken a well-earned rest. I hope to see those posts back up and running in 2024, especially as we approach the concert series in the UK and Europe. Anyway, many thanks to everyone who's been in touch in any way this week, including those who commented on last time's show notes. Bob Martellotta, Doug Curran, Michael J. Quatella, and Greg Clinton. For those interested in my epic composition project in 2024, I've posted the first anthem. Check it out, as they say, by visiting anthem52.com. Only 51 to go now. We're talking about the amazingly titled Electronic Realizations for Rock Orchestra, And Mark is with me now. Hello, Mark.
Hey there, Kevin. How are you doing today?
I'm very well. Happy New Year to you. And how are you?
Good. It's been a rather unsnow-like Christmas time around here and winter in general. But other than that, nothing to complain about.
Excellent. Okay, then here we are in 2024, getting started with our first episode. And we're coming back to this amazing person, Larry Fast, who was responsible for helping Rick Wakeman. So we're asking the question, why did Rick Wakeman want Larry Fast to help him with the sounds and the keyboards on Tales from Topographic Oceans? But we've been listening to this Electronic Realizations for Rock Orchestra album and found out some pretty remarkable things about it. Now, before we go any further, I'd like to thank Michael J. Quatella. I hope that's how you pronounce your name, Michael, who rightly reprimanded me for saying last time that I thought the music on this album was a bit meandering. And now that I've listened to it properly, I don't think it's meandering at all. So thank you very much indeed, Michael, for putting me right on that. So one of the things I sent you, Mark, to have a look at with this album was some comments, I think, which were written by Larry Fast himself when the album originally came out in 1970. No, actually, I think it was later than that. He kept being asked particular questions about the technology that he used and so on. So I think it's worth reading out a couple of things and having a think about those before we talk about the music itself. He says, remember at this time, 1974 to 75, there were no personal computers as we know them. Apple computer didn't exist yet. Microsoft was two hackers selling tiny basic code for other experimenters. Synthesizers were mostly analog and usually restricted to playing one note at a time, no chords. MIDI was years away, and digital recording was still pretty much a development lab project, though a few early classical recordings were being made on specialized equipment. So yes, that's the context, and that's really important, isn't it? Because it's remarkable what he's managed to create with some pretty basic equipment.
Oh yeah, absolutely. I mean, when you listen to the record and you seem to forget that, you know, because now we're living in 2024, the technology that we have as far as keyboards and recording and everything are, you know, million light years ahead of what it was back then, right? When he made the record in 75 and worked on it probably in 74. So like he said, all those kind of developments that we take for granted now, he didn't have any access to it. So to make a record sound the way it did back then, it must have been a tremendous amount of work. I mean, I can only imagine how much, you know, computer, you know, hacking and, you know, stuff like that he had to do for some of these sequences and stuff, because those are really basic, some of these ones. Yeah. Back in the day, like the Moog synthesizers that he was using, like the big ones, not the mini Moog, but like the bigger sized ones, right? So it's pretty daunting. And to think that he came up with such a interesting sounding record with this stuff, it's fantastic.
Yeah. And one of the things, I'll come onto the Mellotron in a minute, but one of the things he used was this thing that he invented himself. It's the galvanic skin response voltage controller, which sounds remarkable. Here's what he said about that. More questions have been asked about this toy than all of the other instruments put together. It's a custom device that I built, which sends a small current through the player's skin. Varying the pressure of any skin surface on a pickup plate causes variation in skin impedance, causing a corresponding change in the controller's voltage output. It is surprisingly easy to control, but not easy to say. When patched for VCO pitch control, it gives sweeping frequencies, much like a ribbon controller. So, okay, let's have a think about this. Much like a ribbon controller. So do you know anything about ribbon controllers, Mark?
Ribbon controller. I'm guessing what he means is like on the keyboard. There's like a little not all keyboards, but like one of the keyboards that I have, the EX7. There's like a little plastic piece here underneath the pitch wheel, and instead of like with the pitch wheel, you can kind of like rotate it and it can like pitch stuff up and down, like right. But with this thing, it's just like a piece of plastic and you put your finger on it and with your skin pressure, it can change the sound. You can slide your finger across it and it'll go like, it'll make all kinds of sounds as you move your finger up across it. And you have to, you know, and it's tactile, right? Like your finger is in control of that stuff. So maybe I'm guessing he's talking about that maybe.
Yes. So, I think that is what he's talking about. And there are There's that amazing book, isn't there, that we had Gerald Bassols on a long time ago. I'm just looking to my right so I can see the name of it. The Musical Instruments of Progressive Rock by Gerald Bassols. And there are quite a few examples in there, I think, of ribbon controllers in the same way. So it put me in mind of I don't know, some kind of android bionic situation where he's connecting himself literally through his skin into the music that he's creating, which is cyborg. That's the word I'm trying to think of.
So
he's actually becoming part of the instrument, which is amazing. Now, the thing he said about the Mellotron, this is a standard Mellotron 400D on this record with the usual flute, strings and cello tapes. The Mellotron actually only appeared on 4-6% of the total tracking of the album. I don't know how he works out as 4-6, but anyway. Since most of the time, synthesized strings and flutes are much cleaner and crisper than the Mellotron's primitive tape playback systems. All Mellotron sounds are controlled tape playbacks of conventional instruments rather than totally electronic sound generation as with a synthesizer. Fascinating. And something else he said was that a lot of these compositions, these creations on this album, were based on or were actually college projects that he'd done himself a few years previously. So it's amazing, isn't it? So there are five songs, and they're not songs because they've got no singing on them, but there are five tracks on this album. Legacy, which is 10 minutes. Slaughter on 10th Avenue, which we'll come back to in a minute, which is 11:50. Synergy, which is the title track, well, you know, the title of the band, as it were, Relay Breakdown and Warriors. And we won't go through each in turn particularly, but there were some things that I wanted to point out. So these are instrumental songs, but if you think of other instrumental albums that we know about and, you know, Rick Wakeman and so on, this was really early, wasn't it, to get this kind of orchestral and the layered way that he's using the instruments here. And, you know, some of it does sound fairly sci-fi-wise, but it also sounds properly constructed, properly put together, like a great cinematic orchestral piece. Certainly the first one, Legacy, I thought very much was like that. So it is remarkable, and it seems to be paving the way for a lot of the use of synthesizers that came after it.
Yeah. That, I absolutely agree. The thing I found interesting about it was that while this is pretty early days as far as this kind of stuff goes, we do have something like it similar being, you know, us Yes fans that we had to listen to, for example, Brahms and Cans, which is like a similar idea where he took a different keyboard, assigned it to a different part of an orchestra and layered it and made it into a track like that. Because this whole album, when I listened to it from beginning to end, And I must give a warning to my fellow people who drive automobiles. This is not the best album to listen to when you're driving, especially at night, because I found I got myself into a bit of a trance. And, you know, I didn't want to go through a red light, you know, half asleep listening to this. Not that it put me to sleep, but it put me into kind of like a trance state sometimes listening to it, because it was very, very computerized. It reminded me back in my teenage days when I used to play, and this is ironic, because when I read the notes about this, about the Commodore 64 and all that stuff, like connection to it, because it said that he did do tracks for Commodore 64 computer games, and I was a big Commodore 64 guy, and a lot of this music made me think back to some of these games that I used to play, like Might and Magic, and, you know, Legacy of the Ancients, and all this stuff, and a lot of this stuff would have fit absolutely perfectly on it. You know, it's unbelievable how I almost look at this album as like if you were to go and get like an orchestra and replace them all with android robots, what would it sound like? It would be kind of something like that, you know?
Yes, I know very much what you're saying there. But I think it doesn't fall into some of the traps that other albums do. And, you know, pointing at Rick Wakeman, and of course this episode is all about why did he want Larry Fast? Well, because Larry Fast could do this kind of thing in the early to mid-70s. Yeah. And it doesn't fall into the trap of getting a bit banal, you know, and a bit simplistic and a bit obvious in some of its melody or harmony. I think it keeps changing, not in a random way, but in a very interesting way. And one of the things that it reminded me of several later artists, I suppose you could call it, or artists who developed in sort of similar ways. And one thing I did remind me of, presumably because of one of the keyboards that he was using, was a film called Educating Rita. Now, I've mentioned this film before. I don't know if it's a film you know, Mark.
Not really, no.
No, it's a very sort of British type film, and it was based, it was filmed in Dublin, Trinity College Dublin. Mm. And it was all about a working class woman who went to university, which at the time were, you know, practically no working class people went to university at the time this was set in the 60s, early 70s, that kind of thing. Anyway, the soundtrack to it was written by David Henshall. And David Henshall, might recognise that name, was a very, very important keyboard wizard for Genesis later on. And his first job was working at Trident Studios, where Queen recorded their first two albums in the unlimited downtime that they were given. And Henshall was involved with that. And so some of the sounds reminded me a little bit of that. But what he did there in that soundtrack was very much more of the classical based thing. So I can't remember whether he actually composed the music himself, but it was supposed to sound like an updated classical piece. And it's slightly more annoying than a lot of the stuff on this album, I think. Another couple of the references or the things that I thought it sounded a bit like were the Flash Gordon soundtrack. So that would be a link through David Henshall back again, and quite a bit of Mike Oldfield, and presumably some bands that I know little about, for example, Soft Machine. So yes, what any obvious references you can hear in this music of this album?
Not really references to other bands. I mean, like I said, the video game thing was immediate. When you mentioned the Flash Gordon, that right away connected. Mm. Because when I saw that movie and that whole Flash, that whole soundtrack to it was very computerized and very futuristic sound. Because, you know, they wanted to make it futuristic. But the one thing that I found kind of not humorous, but that kind of put a smile on my face was that when I was listening to this, when I got to track two, I was kind of like, "Wait a minute, I recognize this."
No, I wonder
because
wondering
I'm
if
a big because yeah. I'm a big Mick Ronson fan.
Yes, right? Yes,
I love Mick Ronson, and he has an album called Slaughter on 10th Avenue, and in fact, he has a version of this song that he does on his album.
Yeah,
right? It's not 11 minutes long; it's only like three and a bit, right? But that right away really put a smile on my face and put this album a little notch higher on my liking, because if it's good enough for Mick Ronson, it's good enough for me to listen to. You know what I mean? Because I love that guy's guitar playing.
Yeah. So Mick Ronson from the Spiders from Mars, isn't he, with Bowie? And he, created this. And I went down another ridiculous rabbit hole trying to find out about this, because Slaughter on 10th Avenue is not, I mean, I knew it was an odd title, but I didn't know of the origins of this second track on this album. And it was, in fact, a Richard Rodgers ballet from the 1940s originally. And so it's got that sort of big band musicals sound in it originally. And I did find a YouTube clip, which I'll put in the show notes for this week, of that ballet. And just an amazing. So it's Gene Kelly and Vera Ellen in Words and Music, 1948, this video, performing Slaughter on 10th Avenue. And when you listen to that, and then you listen to Mr. Ronson playing his version of it, and then listen to this one, it's absolutely fascinating. But again, these rabbit holes always throw up some ridiculous and weird connections. So Mr. Ronson loved Slaughter, as he called it, on 10th Avenue from his childhood piano playing days. So that's why he was keen to put it on his solo album. But there's also the crazy connection that David Henshall plays on Mick Ronson's album. So so he plays the ARP, which is one of those early synthesizers, for Ronson. So, you know, it seems to be such a small world, doesn't it, with everybody playing on each other's records and getting involved with everything.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, they weren't wrong in Walt Disney World when they wrote that song, It's a Small World After All.
Yes.
Right? I mean, it's amazing how these people are connected to one another. I mean, you have him involved with Mick Ronson, and then, you know, later on he gets involved with Peter Gabriel, right, on his records, doing things. And I mean, it has to be said that if you want to know how important Larry Fast is to music in general. Mm. Just listen to Peter Gabriel's first four records. I mean, he's been attributed, especially for album 3 and 4, to be pretty much the driving force behind the sound of that album.
Yeah, absolutely. And that all stemmed from the work that he did for Rick Wakeman, which is absolutely fascinating. Yes. Just the last thing about that Slaughter on 10th Avenue. Really odd to have this such a sort of niche, a sort of small-scale ballet from the 1940s, because not only did the ones that we've just mentioned do cover versions of it, but also The Ventures did an instrumental rock version of it. And and it got to number 35 on the United States Billboard Hot 100 charts. The Shadows released their own version of it. So Cliff Richard and the Shadows, and the Larry Fast and the Mick Ronson. So it's really bizarre, and it set me off thinking about a parallel of Something's Coming, which was one of Yes's very earliest of their arrangements in the Peter Banks era, and then going on to things like America and so on. But at least those had lyrics. I think it's so unusual to have this instrumental track re-recorded and new versions of it done by so many different people. So it's absolutely, absolutely fascinating how it wormed its way into various different parts of popular entertainment.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, it just goes to show you that how strong a composition it was that so many people were taken by it.
Yeah. So just a couple of comments then to finish off on this album and Larry Fast and why Rick Wakeman wanted him. I think it comes down to the amazing way that Larry Fast has managed to create these arrangements using this basic kit, as we've just been saying. And also the last track, I think, Warriors, was really quite progressive. I mean, it seems to have quite a prog structure and mood. It's got parts in 7/4 and different time signatures and so on. And it certainly seemed to me to be telling a story. And I thought it was quite similar in some ways, not in the sound, but in the structure to something like Awaken. So something which has got a real story to tell over an extended period. There were some light-hearted sections, I thought, in Warriors as well, but it never sort of tips over into a jokey thing, which I think Rick Wakeman himself has been slightly tending to do over the years. So certainly pointing towards the sorts of aspects of progressive rock that Yes wanted to get into, and nothing more progressive than Tales from Topographic Oceans, of course.
Yeah, of course. Obviously, Rick was probably, like you said, very enamored by the sounds that he was getting, because after all, look, Rick was one of these guys who was always searching for interesting sounds and fiddling with stuff. Even to this day, when you see him on the Mini Moog, the guy's constantly twiddling knobs and switching things off and on, and he's trying to make, you know, sounds. So this guy is pretty much the master of creating sounds with these kind of difficult to use gear, especially back in the day, you know. Yeah. I mean, and that's also why when you look through the catalog of the stuff that he's contributed to outside of his own music, I mean, you look at Nectar, that's a perfect example of it.
Oh, yes.
You know, he worked with them on, and it's ironic, I have one Nectar album, and it's this one recycled.
Right.
And it provided most of the dominating synthesizers on that album. So obviously, while there were keyboards available, very basic and crude ones, probably, I'm sure, in 75, but to get the sounds that they were getting and wanted to get on these records, you know, a person like Larry Fast is pretty, you know, essential to get that sort of modern sound that they were looking for at the time.
Yeah, absolutely. So, yes, it's pretty clear why Rick Wakeman wanted to use Larry to help him out with Tales, something which just recently, again, the quotation has come up from Rick saying he didn't understand. So in order to get really involved with the piece of music, he had to understand it. He didn't understand Tales. And so perhaps that's one of the reasons he wanted Larry Fast's help. And one last thing that Doug Curran pointed out to me is the Prophet synth. So one of those, again, not, I mean, this was in the 80s, but Larry used the Prophet synth on Kate Bush's Breathing, which is one of my favorite songs from Kate Bush of all time. So, you know, there are so many connections, as we've already said, there's so many places you can hear Larry's amazing keyboard work, and none more exciting and inventive, I think, than this album from Synergy.
Last couple of things to provide here, just for context, is like it says here too that he played additional synthesizer on Foreigner's album 4, which is a pretty huge album. And he also played synthesizer on the 83 single Total Eclipse of the Heart for Bonnie Tyler. I didn't even know that he was involved with that.
Yes, yes. So he's certainly cropping up in an awful lot of places that we all know. So we will certainly have heard his playing and his influence in many places that we don't realise at the moment. It's great. So, Larry Fast, have your say on the show notes. See if you agree with us or you disagree with us. Tell us your recollections of Larry Fast himself, if you have any. But for the moment, thank you very much indeed, Mark.
You're very welcome, Kevin.
This is Miguel Falcón at miguelbass.com. You are listening to the Yes Music Podcast.
Just before we go, here are the YMP producers and half the patrons. Yes Music Podcast producers are Joseph Cottrell, Ken Fuller and Jeffrey Cresselius. And half the Yes Music Podcast patrons are Jim Morrison, John Pickles, Declan Logg, Gary Betts, Alan Begg, Michael Handahan, Barry Gorski, Steve Perry, Doug Curran, Martin Kelberg, Todd Dudley, Rachel Hadaway, Lind, Paul Hales, Craig Estenes, Mark James Lang, Steve Rode, David, Bob Martellotta, John Holden, Stephen Lamb, Dem, Fred Barringer, Scott Colombo, Chris Bandini, David Hayden, and John Thompson. As we start the new year, why not consider joining those patrons to help keep the lights on here at YMP Towers? Just head over to patreon.com, patreon.com/yesmusicpodcast, or click the link on yesmusicpodcast.com. Many thanks, of course, as always, to all those patrons and producers. So that's just about all the time we have this week. Thanks so much for listening once again. We do hope to be back next week. And in the meantime, please do keep listening and getting involved via X, Facebook or Instagram. So until next time, just remember, whatever your progressive rock question, the answer is yes.